Interesting passage we have here. Something that's counterintuitive. When I'm weak, then I'm strong. My strength is perfected in weakness, God tells the Apostle Paul. And you think for a moment, why would that be? Why would that be so important? Why would it be so important that God would allow the Apostle Paul to be tormented, to have this thing that Paul prays once, twice, three times that God would take away from him? But God says, no, I actually sent it. And what did I send it for? Well, Paul tells us very clearly, I was sent this thing so that I would not boast. Do you know all the great things I've seen? I went up to heaven. I saw things that man cannot even express. Do you know all the things that I've seen that you haven't seen? You want to challenge my apostleship? You want to say that I'm not an apostle? You want to say that you have better teaching than I do? Let me tell you how great I am. Have you been up to heaven? Have you seen these things? Have you spoken with the angels? Have you done any of this? God says, no, no, no. We got to be careful here. I'm going to send you a preventative medicine that's going to keep you grounded. You think about medicine, what kinds of medicines are there? There are medicines that are curative, and there are medicines that are preventative. That is, there are medicines you take in order to not get sick, and there are medicines you take after you've gotten sick. The same thing with exercise. You can exercise in order to have better functionality of your body, or if you have some accident or, you know, whatever happens and you lose functionality of your body, what do? You go to physical therapy and they do exercise. It can be preventative or it can be curative. I'm going to give you this preventative medicine so that you don't get too high on yourself. And this is a theme throughout the Bible. Be careful not to boast. Be careful not to think of yourself as something you are not. In fact, in Ephesians 2, what does it say? You're saved by faith through grace. Why? Not of works, lest any man should boast. I don't want any boasting. God doesn't want any boasting. You know, humans are very bad. I speak for myself as well. We're very bad at attributing the credit for something and attributing the blame for something. Why is that? Because we're mired in ignorance. We're mired in our biases. You know, something, my favorite politician wins and something bad happens. Well, it was everybody around him. It was their fault, the opposition's fault. They wouldn't let him do what he wanted. And of course, the other side would say, no, it was his fault because he was doing what he wanted. And then when the things flip, my ideas change because I'm a weak, silly creature. If there's any chance that something good happened, and there's any chance, any possibility that I can attribute that good thing happening to myself, chances are I'm going to take it. Yeah, it's probably me. And on the contrary, if there's anything bad happened, and there's any possibility that I can divert the blame, I'm going to say, yeah, it probably wasn't my fault. That's just how we are. We have to work not to be like that. And God sends Paul this thorn in the flesh so that he will stay grounded and he will see things more clearly. He won't get a big head. And we're going to explore this idea of strength through weakness and remembering and being able to see clearly to whom is due the glory through the story of Gideon. In Judges chapter 6. Now what's the, you know, you've ever been to a class on the Judges, the first thing they say, they're the cycles. The cycles. What are the cycles? Well, it's quite simple. Israelites go into apostasy, that is, they start disobeying God. They fall into oppression by some foreign power. And then they cry out and they say, God, help us. And God sends a judge. And then they get on the right track for a while, and then the cycle repeats. They fall into sin. They cry out. God sends a judge. They fall into sin. They cry out. God sends a judge. And, you know, the only thing I would add to that is that we should not think that that cycle ended with the book of Judges. That cycle continued throughout the kings. Remember last time we were looking at Daniel in captivity. Why were they in captivity? Because of their sin. And they went in captivity one more time, and the 10 tribes were gone, wiped out. They just, as oftentimes happens when we think we have a solution for a problem and we misdiagnose the problem. Hey, I know what the problem is. We're not like the nations around us. No, your problem was sin. That was your problem. But we misdiagnose the problem and we say we've got a solution. We need a king. Well, you do need a king, God. But they say, we need a king like the nations around us. So they don't actually solve the problem. They just transmute the problem. Now it's just, when there's a good king, things are good. When there's a bad king, which was more often than not, things are bad. And even in the time of Jesus, what was the state of the Israelites? Do you remember? Well, they were free, more or less. Yet they paid taxes to the Romans. They were in the soft bondage. And in fact, in John chapter 18, what we read this morning at the Lord's Supper, they're talking to Pilate there, and Pilate says about Jesus, they're talking to Pilate about Jesus, and they say, we need this guy killed, basically. And Pilate says, this doesn't mean anything to me. I don't care about this. Get it out of my face. Go judge him according to your law. And what do they say? Well, you know as well as anybody that we don't have the authority to execute our law. We can't kill him. If we kill him, what are you going to say? We say, oh, that was according to our law. Okay, tell it to your cellmate. You're going to be in prison. You're going to be or killed yourself. Just like today, if somebody said, well, I'm just following the law of Moses in the United States. That's why I stoned that guy, we'd say. Well, enjoy yourself. You know, we don't care about that. We have laws of the land. You're under these laws, not the law of Moses. So they were under the laws of the Romans, not enslaved as they were in Egypt, not enslaved as they were in Assyria, not enslaved as they were in Babylon, but still not free. Okay? Let's start in verse 1. It's important to get the context here. First 10 verses, we'll go through this very quickly. Then the sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Notice this, this horrible situation is clearly attributed to them doing evil. Okay. And the Lord gave them into the hand of Midian 7 years. The power of Midian prevailed against Israel because of Midian. The sons of Israel made for themselves the dens which were in the mountains and the caves and the strongholds. For it was when Israel had sown that the Midianites would come up with the Amalekites and the sons of the east and go against them. So they would camp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza and leave no sustenance in Israel as well as no sheep, ox, or donkey. For they would come up with their livestock, with their tents, and they would come in like locusts for number. But they and their camels were innumerable. And they came into the land to devastate it. So Israel was brought very low because of Midian, and the sons of Israel cried to the Lord. How bad was the situation? Imagine how bad this is. One of the things we have to do when reading the Old Testament is get out of the, the kind of Sunday school mentality where, you know, it's just a very simple story. No, you got to put yourself in their position. And note that these are real people with real lives, with real problems, with real connections, with memories, with lives just as complex as yours and mine. And these people were oppressed so much. Imagine this. You're oppressed so much when you hear word of the enemy, you've got to go live in a cave. You've got to go live in a fox den. What kind of life is that? That's miserable. That's horrible. Don't have enough food. Don't have any peace of mind. You never know when you're going to have your things stolen, when your family's going to be taken, when they're going to be raped, when you're going to be killed. Horrible life. And why was it, what brought this on? Their sin. It's oftentimes, notice verse 6. So Israel was brought very low because of Midian, and the sons of Israel cried to the Lord. So often it is that you want God to hear you, but you don't want to hear God. What was the problem? We didn't want to hear God. He told us to do some things, we didn't want to do them. But now we're in trouble, now we want him to hear us. A story as old as time. Verse 7. Now it came about when the sons of Israel cried to the Lord on account of Midian, that the Lord sent a prophet to the sons of Israel, and he said to them, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, was I who brought you up from Egypt and brought you out of the house of slavery. I delivered you from the hands of the Egyptians and from the hands of all your oppressors and dispossessed them before you and gave you their land. And I said to you, I am the Lord your God. You shall not fear the gods of the Amorites in whose land you live, but you have not obeyed me. Okay. This is kind of a strange prophecy, isn't it? If you were in this situation and you heard, hey, there's a new prophecy, what would you think? Well, one, you might be hopeful that God's going to say, I'm going to deliver you. Or two, you might be fearful that God's going to say, you thought those last 7 years were bad? Well, buckle up. You're in for a real rough ride now. But he doesn't seem to say anything of the like. He just mentions some historical facts. And he mentions at the end their disobedience. So it's a very strange. How do we interpret this? It's very strange. Let's keep going. Verse 11. Then the angel of the Lord came and sat under the oak that was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, as his son Gideon was beating out wheat in the winepress in order to save it from the Midianites. The angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, "The Lord is with you, O valiant warrior." Then Gideon said to him, O my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us and given us into the hand of Midian. Okay, let's stop there for a moment. So Gideon's there, and what's he doing? He's in a wine press. Got some natural protection. People can't see you from a distance. So he's in there and he's separating the wheat from the chaff. Why is he doing that? Because if the Midianites see him, what are they going to do? They're going to come and take the food. And then his family and then his neighbors are not going to have the food. It's very simple. And you could say, well, if he was really a mighty warrior, why wouldn't he fight them all? Maybe you've seen Rambo too many times. One man cannot fight an army. I don't care how strong you are, how fierce you are, one man cannot fight an army. Okay? That's one of the points of this lesson. Don't rely on yourself. You can't fight an army. You're not Rambo. Rambo is not a documentary. It's a Hollywood fiction. Okay? He says, mighty man of valor, O valiant warrior. And he says, what's Gideon say? Well, I'm a little confused here. If what you're saying is true, why am I seeing what I'm seeing? Why are we in such dire straits? If what you're saying is true, why does reality not comport with what you're saying? Verse 14, the Lord looked at him and said, go in this your strength and deliver Israel from the hand of Midian. Have I not sent you? Okay, that last part is very important. Have I not sent you? He said to him, O Lord, how shall I deliver Israel? Behold, My family is the least in Manasseh, and I'm the youngest in my father's house. But the Lord said to him, surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat Midian as one man. Okay, what do we see here? We see some, now you could be cynical and say we see some fear. And certainly there was fear. Remember, Gideon was a real man with all the same weaknesses we have, with all the same complexities we have. He was a real person. Of course you're going to be afraid. But heroism is not necessary. Obedience is necessary. You can be afraid. He was afraid. But he actually did it as well. And before we're so quick to criticize him, have you ever been afraid to carry out any of the commands of God? Have you ever been afraid to speak up, to tell somebody something, to maybe rebuke somebody? Have you ever been afraid to do anything like that? And then I sit up here in comfort and say, I could have fought that army. I would have died. I wouldn't have been afraid. You know, to hear some people tell it, you know, they would have, in every situation in the Bible, they would have been that comic book character that has no flaws, that unsophisticated writing that so many bad books have, where the characters are all good or all bad. They're not real people. It's all good or all bad. You know, if I were Peter when the storm was going and I was called to walk out on that water, I would have gone out. I would have been figure skating on that water. I would have been doing triple salchows. My faith is so strong. You see, it's just my faith is so much stronger than everybody else's, than Peter's and everybody else's. Now, I've never been in that situation, and, you know, I kind of get scared sometimes doing these lesser things. But if I were in that situation and I knew that I'd be in the Bible, I would have certainly put everyone else to shame. Some humility is in order. Okay? Verse 14, the Lord looked at him and said, go in this your strength and deliver Israel from the hand of Midian. Have I not sent you? He said to him, O Lord, how shall I deliver Israel? Behold, my family is the least in Manasseh. Now you say, this sounds very much like Moses. This sounds very much like Saul at the beginning. Remember Saul started out so well? What was his problem? He then started drinking his own Kool-Aid. He then started to say, well, at first I didn't think I was worthy, but now I kind of think I'm the most worthy. Now I kind of think I'm really something. That was the problem. So Gideon is in a very good position here. He's humble. He's humble. In fact, what about Moses? Remember how Moses started? He kills that Egyptian, and what's he say? What do we find out he says in Acts? I thought they would all understand that I was there to deliver them. I started the deliverance. What's God do? He sends him out in the desert for 40 years to watch the sheep. And then when God encounters him at the burning bush, what does Moses say? I'm not worthy. Perfect. That's the attitude you need to have. But the Lord said to him, surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat Midian as one man. So Gideon said to him, if now I have found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that it is you who speak with me. Okay, so what can we tell from this? That as many times throughout the Bible, God appears, and you know, a lot of people think this is a theophany, an appearance of God, an appearance of Christ in particular. You know, we don't have time to go into that, but it very well could be. And but he appears as a regular man. This wasn't an angel, didn't have wings, he wasn't glowing, there was no halo, there was no, you know, he wasn't levitating or anything like that. I think I'm just talking to a regular person, as so many times happens. You remember Abraham talking to the three before Sodom and Gomorrah is destroyed. You remember Joshua when he saw the man with his sword drawn. He didn't say, oh, it's a supernatural being. He said, no, are you on our side or their side? So at this point, he thinks this is just some guy. I don't know who it is. So Gideon said to him, "If now I have found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that it is you who speaks with me." Is that a lack of faith? No, I need some proof. I need some proof. There are many, go down to Nashville, there are many people claiming to be angelic. They're claiming to be apostles. They're claiming to be Jesus. Asking for proof, there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, not asking for proof, there's something wrong with that. Being gullible is not a virtue. Ignorance is not a virtue. "Please do not depart from here until I come back to you and bring out my offering and lay it before you." And he said, "I will remain until you return." Then Gideon went and prepared a young goat and unleavened bread from an ephah flour. He put the meat in a basket and the broth in a pot and brought them out to him under the oak and presented them. The angel of God said to him, "Take the meat and the unleavened bread and lay them on this rock and pour out the broth." And he did so. Then the angel of the Lord put out the end of the staff that was in his hand and touched the meat and the unleavened bread, and fire sprang up from the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened bread. Then the angel of the Lord vanished from his sight. Confirmation. When Gideon saw that he was the angel of the Lord, he said, "Alas, O Lord God, for now I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face." The Lord said to him, "Peace to you. Do not fear. You shall not die." This was a common thought. We see this over and over, especially in the book of Judges, but through the Old Testament. "I've seen God. I'm going to die. Surely I'm going to die." Then Gideon built an altar there to the Lord and named it, "The Lord is Peace." To this day, it is still in Ophrah of the Abizrites. Okay, and you say, all right, on to the battle. We're being oppressed by Midian. I've gotten this message from God. Let's go kill some Midianites. But that's not what happens. What happens? We've got to take care of the real problem. What's the real problem? The Midianites? No, they're not the real problem. What brought on the Midianites? The sin. So we're going to have to take care of that first. Verse 25, "Now in the same night the Lord said to him, 'Take your father's bull and the second bull, 7 years old, and pull down the altar of Baal, from which belonged to your father.'" Interesting. "And cut down the Asherah that is beside it, and build an altar to the Lord your God on top of the stronghold in an orderly manner, and take a second bull and offer a burnt offering with the wood of the Asherah which you shall cut down.' And Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had spoken to him. And because he was too afraid of his father's household and the men of the city to do it by day, he did it by night." Okay, again, afraid, afraid. But before we're too hard on him, this would be something very difficult to do, especially when your father's involved, especially when everyone you know is involved. A very difficult task. Afraid, but he actually did it. Okay? Afraid, but he actually did it. And how's Gideon remembered, by the way? How's the New Testament remembering? Where is he? He's in that, you know, you could call it what you want. Let's call it the list of the most faithful of the Old Testament. He is brought out as being faithful. This is someone you should look to. This is someone you should aspire to be as faithful as. Okay, verse 28. "When the men of the city arose early in the morning, behold, the altar of Baal was torn down, and the Asherah which was beside it was cut down, and the second bull was offered on the altar which had been built. They said to one another, 'Who did this thing?'" And think about that. If you were really a follower of Baal, if you really believed in that kind of thing, what kind of an outrage would this be to you? This is outrageous. Whoever did this must die. They desecrated my holy altar. They said to one another, "Who did this thing?" And when they searched about and inquired and said, "Gideon, the son of Joash, did this thing." Then the men of the city said to Joash, "Bring out your son that he may die, for he has torn down the altar of Baal, and indeed he has cut down the Asherah which was beside it. He's an apostate. He's an infidel. He's not faithful to our religion. He's got to die. But Joash said to all who stood against him, remember who owned this thing? It was Joash, but he chose his son over his false god. But Joash said to all who stood against him, who will contend for Baal? Or who will deliver him? Whoever will plead for him shall be put to death by morning. If he is a god, let him contend for himself because someone has torn down his altar. Let's see if he's actually a god. Let's see if he actually can defend himself. Or does he need you humans to do it for him? Let's see. Let's see if he actually has any power. Verse 32, therefore on that day he named him Jerubbaal. That is to say, let Baal contend against him, because he had torn down his altar. So Gideon is renamed Jerubbaal. This is a defining moment in his life. He's taken on Baal, and he's won. Okay, this is preparing him for the next chapter. Verse 33, then all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the sons of the east assembled themselves, and they crossed over and camped in the valley of Jezreel. So the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet. And the Abiezerites were called together to follow him. He sent messengers throughout Manasseh, and they also were called together to follow him. And he sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali. And they went up to meet there. Then Gideon said to God, if you will deliver Israel through me, notice that, he has no grand ideas of himself. He says, if you, God, will deliver Israel through me, I'm simply the tool in your hand. If you will deliver Israel through me, as you have spoken, behold, I will put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece only, and it is dry on all the ground around, then I will know that you will deliver Israel through me as you have spoken. Okay, so what's he want here? Okay, again, remember, I've got all these men together. I'm about to go to war. And we're outnumbered. Do you think in any man, even someone in the SEALs, do you think there'd be a little nervous energy there? Yeah, there's some nervous energy there. There's some fear. Death is right around the corner. Death is lurking around every corner. Certain death. Of course I'm going to be scared. I'm human. Okay? So I want to make sure that I actually know what I'm talking about before I send myself and all these other people on a suicide mission. I better make sure. I better double check here. Okay? And by the way, also, could there be any time where, circumstances change? What did God tell the Israelites when they were coming into the land? I'm going to give you all this land. You're going to take on these people. You're going to conquer them. Oops. There was some sin in the camp. Oh, Achan took some stuff he ought not have taken. And what happened? We went into battle thinking all was good. It wasn't all good. We suffered a humiliating defeat. So I better make sure. It's only responsible. Behold, I will put a... Now, what do I want? I want some miracle. Okay? I'm going to put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. And if there's dew on the fleece only, that is, when I come back in the morning, if the fleece is wet and everything else is dry, then I'll know. Okay? And what happens? Verse 38. And it was so. When he arose early the next morning and squeezed the fleece, he drained the dew from the fleece a bowl full of water. So everything else is dry. The fleece is quite wet. We don't know how big the fleece was or what exactly a bowl of water is. But it was wet enough to get water out of it. And Gideon said, verse 39, and Gideon said to God, do not let your anger burn against me. I know I'm pushing it here. I realize I'm pushing it. Do not let your anger burn against me, that I may speak once more. Please let me make a test once more with this fleece. You know, maybe that's just the natural properties of this material. I'm no material scientist. Maybe this material holds water better than the surrounding area. I don't know. What do I know? Do not let your anger burn against me, that I may speak once more. Please let me make a test once more with this fleece. Let it now be dry only on the fleece, and let there be dew on all the ground. Let me reverse the things. If it was a natural property of the fleece, then there's no way the reversal would work naturally. It'd have to be supernatural. And before I go into battle, before I put my own life on the line, before I put all these other people's life on the line, imagine that. I go into battle with these people and we're slaughtered, and I come back and I tell the widows and the children that lost their fathers and their brothers, oh, sorry, I misinterpreted a dream there. Sorry about that. My bad. I guess I should have double checked. Everyone makes mistakes. Midian's probably coming to rape and pillage here. Anyway, good luck with that. Let me make sure here. Let me be double sure. Please let me make this one more test of the fleece. And did God get angry with him, by the way? God did so that night, for it was dry only on the fleece and dew was on all the ground. God complied. Reminds me of what Jesus says to his disciples in John 14. If you don't believe me for my words, at least believe me for the signs that I did. That's why I did them. I don't want you to have no evidence. I don't want you to have no proof. I don't want you to have blind faith. That's not something to brag about. I've got blind faith. All the evidence says I'm wrong, but I don't care. That's not something to boast about. Okay, chapter 7. Then Zerubbabel, that is Gideon, and all the people who were with him rose early and camped beside the spring of Herod. And the camp of Midian was on the north side of them by the hill of Moreh in the valley. The Lord said to Gideon, the people who are with you are too many for me to give Midian into their hand, for Israel would become boastful, saying, my own power has delivered me. What an interesting verse. Now, if you were an outsider and you looked at this situation, you would say, Israel does not have enough people. They don't have enough people to win this battle. God looks at it in a completely different way. You have too many people. There are too many people for me to give this battle into your hand. Why? Because you're so foolish. You're drowning in so much ignorance that after winning, you're going to say, hey, that was me. The same way we can say, look, I've been saved. I've been cleansed of my sins. That was me. I'm great. Why aren't you other people like me? If you were only as holy, as set apart, as humble as I was, then you would be saved as well. You poor people, you poor things. So there are too many people. So we're going to have some filters. Verse 3. Now therefore come, proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, whoever is afraid and trembling, let him return and depart from Mount Gilead. Notice how many people. The vast majority. 22,000 people returned, but 10,000 remained. If anyone is fearful and trembling, you think the other 10,000 weren't fearful? Yeah, they were probably fearful, but they had enough courage to stay. I am fearful, but I'm going to stay. But the others were fearful and trembling. And God says, let them return. Verse 4, then the Lord said to Gideon, the people are still too many. Now, think about what Gideon's thinking about after seeing, 2/3 of his army leave. What would you be thinking in your head? This is a disaster. This is a disaster. What's going to happen now? 2/3 of my army just left. I was already undermanned, and now I'm left with 1/3? What kind of thing is this? But God says, yeah, what kind of thing is this? There are still way too many. Then the Lord said to Gideon, these people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. Therefore it shall be that he of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, he shall go with you. But every one of whom I say to you, this one shall not go with you, he shall not go with you. So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, you shall separate everyone who laps the water with his tongue as a dog laps, as well as everyone who kneels to drink. Now the number of those who had lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men. But all the rest of the people kneeled to drink the water. Okay. This reminds me of what, you remember in the book of Kings what Jonathan said when he's facing that garrison, him and his sword bearer? He said, God can deliver whether they be many or whether we be few. I wonder if he thought back to this story. It doesn't matter how many men. It doesn't matter what our strength is. It doesn't matter what our intelligence is. It doesn't matter how advanced our military stratagems are. What matters is God with us or is he not? If he's with us, it doesn't matter how many men there are. And if he's not with us, again, it doesn't matter how many men there are for us or against us. If God's with us, we will win. If he's against us, we're going to lose. That's the only thing that matters. Now, you might notice that, who did we eliminate here? We eliminated those who were fearful to the point of trembling. And you know, before you criticize, I've never been about to go out into a war. I've never looked over a valley and saw innumerable people with innumerable weapons ready to slice my head off. You know, I'm a programmer, I'm not a warrior. You know, I think about those men on D-Day waiting for that ship door to open, facing certain death. Even seeing it in movies is terrifying. So I'm not going to criticize these people. But they were fearful so much that they were trembling. He said, go home. That was the majority. And then the second filter was, okay, if you put your head down in the water to drink, you go home as well. Now, some would say, well, the best warriors were remaining. Those who have the least amount of fear and those who have some common sense of what to do when the enemy is around. Never put your guard down. Let your guard down. But get the water with your hand and bring it to your mouth. And, you know, that sounds good. They probably were the best warriors. But the point of the story is it does not matter. That's the point of the story. It doesn't matter. And by the way, can 300 well-trained soldiers, the 300 most valiant men, take on an army? No. No. You know, we have the story of the past in the Grecian war there, and 300 men defended that small pass because of the territory, but what happened to those 300 men? They died, and they lost. Okay, 300 men cannot take on an army. It doesn't matter who you are. Verse 7, the Lord said to Gideon, I will deliver you with the 300 men who lapped and will give the Midianites into your hand, so let all the other people go, each man to his home. So the 300 men took the people's provisions and the trumpets into their hands, and Gideon sent all the other men of Israel, each to his tent, but retained the 300 men, and the camp of Midian was below him in the valley. Now the same night it came about that the Lord said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I have given it into your hand. But if you are afraid to go down, go with Purim, your servant, down to the camp, and you will hear what they say. And afterward, your hand will be strengthened, that you may go down against the camp. Notice how accommodating God is. Even if you're still, does that give you any comfort? Even if you're still afraid, after all of this, after seeing the miracles, after I've whittled down your army, I've told you I'm going to give them into your hand. But if your mind starts to think, well, I'm looking at my people over here, these 300 people, and then I'm looking down there and I can't even count them. How's this going to work? If you're still afraid, which is natural, why don't you go down there, sneak into the camp, and hear what they have to say. Let me give you one more sign before you go. And you will hear what they say, and afterward your hands will be strengthened. You'll be encouraged that you may go down against the camp. So he went with Purah, his servant, down to the outpost of the army that was in the camp. Now the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the sons of the east were lying in the valleys as numerous as locusts. Imagine looking down on that. That's got to be a terrifying sight. All these men, and these aren't, you know, these aren't children, these aren't programmers, these aren't, you know, people working out, you know, a grocery store or something. These are warriors. You're looking down, and these men are ready to take your head off, okay? How many are there? I don't know. There are too many to count. Oh, but I wouldn't have any fear. I'm too faithful for that. And you will hear what they say, and afterward your hand will be strengthened. Verse 12. Now the Midianite, or verse 13 actually, when Gideon came, behold, a man was relating a dream to his friend, and he said, behold, I had a dream. What was the dream? A loaf of barley bread was tumbling into the camp of Midian, and it came to the tent and struck it so that it fell, and it turned it upside down so that the tent lay flat. Now notice that. How offensive is a loaf of barley bread? When you're constructing a tent, do you ever worry that a loaf of bread is going to come rolling down to take it out? Is that something that goes through you think, well, man, maybe a bear, maybe a moose, maybe something like that. A loaf of bread doesn't have any power. Well, it doesn't have any power except when God is using it. Gideon does not have any power except when God is using him. A loaf of barley bread, and you know, we don't have time to go into it, but notice the similarity between this dream and the statue in Daniel, where the rock that was cut out of the mountain without hands came down, and it destroyed the statue that represented the four great kingdoms. And in fact, we'll make that application at the end. Verse 14, his friend replied, this is nothing less than the sword of Gideon. So word had gotten out, apparently, that Gideon is planning something. The son of Joash, a man of Israel, God has given Midian and all the camp into his hand. Now this could be a prophecy. Do people ever prophesy in the Bible without knowing it? Yes. The high priest, Caiaphas, in John tells us explicitly that he prophesied that year being the high priest. He didn't know he was prophesying. He thought he was just, planning. We need to kill this Jesus so everybody else, so all Israel can be saved. Well, he was prophesying. Could very well be that this man is also prophesying. When Gideon heard the account of the dream and its interpretation, he bowed and worshiped. He returned to the camp of Israel and said, arise. For the Lord has given the camp of Midian into your hand. He divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put trumpets and empty pitchers into the hands of all the men with torches inside the pitchers. He said to them, look at me and do likewise, and behold, when I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do. When I and all who are with me blow the trumpet, then you will blow the trumpet all around the camp and say, for the Lord and for Gideon. So Gideon and 100 men who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp in the beginning of the middle watch, and they had just posted the watch, and they blew the trumpets and smashed the pitchers that were in their hand. When the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers, they held the torches in their left hand and the trumpets in their right hand for blowing, and cried, a sword for the Lord and for Gideon. Notice what's not in either one of their hands. There are no bows and arrows. There are no swords, there are no spears, there are no weapons. As if it would make any difference anyway. 300 swords are not going to make any difference against that number of people. But how does God see the situation? Strength down here, weakness up here. What am I going to do? I'm simply going to use the strength against itself. I'm going to make the strength cave in against itself, and the strength will fight against the strength. And so defeat itself. A house divided by itself cannot stand. Verse 21, each stood in his place around the camp, and all the army ran, crying out as they fled. When they blew 300 trumpets, the Lord set the swords of one against another, even throughout the whole army, and the army fled as far as Beth Shittah, toward Zerah, as far as the edge of Abel Meholah, by Tabith. The men of Israel were summoned from Naphtali, from Asher, and all Manasseh, and they pursued Midian. All right, now they're on the run. Let's get everybody involved. Let's go, you know, clean up what's left over. Gideon sent messengers throughout all the hill country of Ephraim, saying, come down against Midian and take the waters before them as far as Bethbara to the Jordan. So all the men of Ephraim were summoned, and they took the waters as far as Bethbara to the Jordan. They captured the two leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, and they killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and they killed Zeb at the winepress of Zeb. While they pursued Midian, and they brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon from across the Jordan. And so, victory has been achieved. These 300 men were able to defeat these innumerable men without weapons of war, without bow and arrow, without spear, without sword, without the appropriate amount of soldiers. They were able to overtake this innumerable army. How is that? Well, it's very simple. God was fighting for them. And I mentioned before how it's very similar to the vision of the rock coming down and smiting that statue in that dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. And what did that statue represent? We'll end with this. What did that statue represent? Think about that. The four great nations. You think about Babylon. We don't really think it was that great, but apparently it was the greatest. The Medes and the Persians, we don't know that much about them. Then the Greeks, we know a lot about the Greeks. We have a high opinion of the Greeks. The Greeks were great. The Greeks were magnificent. Their architecture, their mathematics, the things they knew, the things they did, the things they left for us, fantastic. The Romans, everyone knows about the Romans. The greatest empires of the world. And what empire is going to take them all out? Oh, this king, going back to John 18, Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this realm. My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight. This kingdom started by this carpenter and these fishermen, not scribes, not Pharisees, perhaps some of them not even literate. And yet, which kingdom has lasted? Which kingdom has lasted? Which kingdom has spread throughout all the world? Which kingdom will last throughout all eternity? It's not Babylon. It's not the Greeks. It's not the Romans. It's this little rock that's come rolling down the hill and struck this great statue and demolished it. That's what relying on God does. And you know, you could look at Peter, you could look at John, you could look at any of them and say, I'm not qualified to lead a new kingdom. I'm not qualified to be in this position. I'm a fisherman. In fact, when they see Jesus has died, what do they do? We're going out fishing. We're fishermen. That's what we do. That's how we make a living. That's what we know how to do. That's what we're good at doing. That's what we're going to do. I am in no way to qualify. Do you think I'm better than Nebuchadnezzar? Do you think I'm better than Julius Caesar? Do you think I'm better than all these people? Don't rely on yourself. That's a very good attitude. You shouldn't think you're better than any of those people. You're not better than any of those people. But you have enough humility to actually be strong. You have enough humility to be strong enough to withstand the sands of time. Those who lift themselves up will be abased. Those who abase themselves will be lifted up. Those who rely on themselves will ultimately be found wanting and be crushed. Those who rely on God will never be disappointed. So,
I think there are a lot of things we can take from this lesson that are very give us a lot of motivation, comfort us. If I'm fearful to do things, okay, fine, I'm human, I'm weak, I'm ignorant. But do I actually go ahead and go through the fear and do them? That's the question. I'm scared to say that to that person. I'm scared to talk to that person. A lot different than I'm scared to go to war with those 100,000 people. But I'm scared to do these things. Well, okay. That doesn't mean that you are absolved from the duty of doing it. You need to do it. Being scared's fine. Just do it. Okay? God was so accommodating with Gideon. Has it been your experience that God has been accommodating with you? Have you ever faltered? Have you ever been weak? Have you ever been doubting? Have you ever had any fear? Were you struck dead? Did you get any message saying, away with you? I want nothing to do with you. You're not worthy. Even Peter, who denied the Lord 3 times, what would anybody expect? You had your chance, get out. No, I've still got something for you. Come in. You still got work to do. As imperfect as you are, don't rely on your own strength. You're looking at your own weaknesses, fine. But now, rely on my strength and you can do great things. But then, after you've done the great things, don't look back and say, it was by my hand. No, it was by the hand of God. We need to remember that we can do, you know, John 15. Apart from me, what's Jesus say? You can do some things. Apart from me, you can do almost nothing. No, apart from me, you can do no thing. Nothing. Nothing good. Eternally good. We need to rely on God, and if we are found to be abiding in Him, we will be fruitful. Thank you for listening. I hope this has been helpful to you. If you have any